KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
We do have a segment of our population here that would frankly like us to somehow sort of put Bellingham as it exists today into some sort of a sealed dome.
One of the reasons to designate certain areas as urban centers is to take the pressure of growth off our single-family neighborhoods.
I view this as pro-worker. I don't view this as anti-union. If anything, it gives the unions a chance to step back and say, what are they doing to give value to workers?
Right to work, densification, coal terminals. Wow, jam-packed hour here from 94.9 KUOW. I'm Marcy Silman. This is Weekday. Hundreds, maybe thousands of people are expected to turn up this afternoon at the Washington State Trade and Convention Center. Officials from the State Department of Ecology, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and from Whatcom County are in Seattle to take public testimony on a proposed coal export terminal. KOW's Ashley Ahern has been covering this issue, it seems like, for months, Ashley, and thanks for coming in to talk about what's at stake. I guess just let's take a step back. What has been proposed to be built?
The Gateway Pacific Terminal would be built north of Bellingham. It would be the largest coal export terminal on the West Coast if it is built. It would export up to 48 million tons of coal per year, and that would basically double the amount that Canada is putting out. It's the equivalent to the total amount that Canada exports right now.
And so the coal that would be
on the West Coast, excuse me.
The coal that would be exported from that terminal comes from all over the West Coast?
Yes. And as some of our listeners might have heard, I traveled to Wyoming this summer and did a full feature, two-part series, actually, about the coal export issue from Wyoming's perspective, because the Powder River Basin is basically our Saudi Arabia of coal. It's a huge concentration of coal in the U.S. And as domestic demand for coal declines, those companies are looking to get that coal out. And so Asia is looking like the most promising market, India and China specifically. And guess what? Northwest is in the way.
Well, we're on the ocean, I suppose, or close to the ocean.
Yes.
So this is proposed for north of Bellingham. Why are they holding a hearing in Seattle?
This is the most fascinating thing about this issue is that, while it's one thing to say we're going to build a terminal over here, that coal has to get there somehow. And the way it gets there is by train. And so those trains would be traveling from Montana and from Wyoming through Spokane, following the existing train routes down along the Columbia River Gorge. You picturing the map of Washington?
Yeah, I am. Got it in my mind.
So then they hit Portland and then they head north through Vancouver, Washington, and up through Seattle and up to Bellingham and Cherry Point. And so, as you might imagine, that has communities all along those rail lines asking important questions.
So is the increased train travel what they're questioning? Is it what's on the trains? I mean, what's at the heart of people's opposition?
I think people, from what I've learned in my reporting, people come at this from a lot of different directions. There are the people that are, the NIMBY, not in my backyard, I don't want coal trains going through my community. And then there are the big picture, opponents to coal burning and fossil fuel usage and continuing to promote the usage of coal around the globe by exporting our coal to markets that want it. So I think that it's multifaceted. There are those that don't want trains coming through for safety reasons, for, community flow, connectivity, that sort of thing. Local businesses are worried about impacts. There are people that are raising concerns about coal dust, diesel particulate matter from the trains. There are a lot of different facets to this and a lot of different areas of concern, I think, for people.
Are we already seeing coal go through on trains somewhere around
yes.
here?
Okay. Yes, we are. There are three kind of major Canadian coal export terminals. The largest in West Shore, which is, Tawasin, just north of us, near Vancouver. Mm. And they've just increased their capacity to 33 million tons a year. So remember, the Gateway Pacific would be 48, 54 total. So still, we'd be much bigger. And I have some good contacts up there and have learned that, they can't take very much coal. They're at max capacity. If you've ever seen West Shore, if you've come in on that ferry from Vancouver Island, you can see the terminal, and it exists as this kind of plot, like chunk of land, little island, and there's only so much coal you can fit on there, and there are only so many ships that can come in and service it. So,
are they mostly exporting Canadian coal?
That's the other problem. They are taking 8 million tons of Powder River Basin coal now at West Shore, but they can take up to 10, is what they were telling me. About 2 million more tons. That's not very much. And so they're also, a lot of that is already contracted for BC coal, Western Canada coal.
So I'm holding up my hand, listeners. You can't see this. There's the whole issue of fossil fuel, burning coal, mining coal, exporting coal. There's the issue of trains and the safety of increased train traffic.
Sure.
And there's people who are questioning sort of not in my backyard issues. It seems like we're rife with people opposing it. Who supports the idea of building the terminal?
There is strong support for building the terminal. A lot of labor unions, both in Whatcom County and up north, but also around here, the Trainsmen's Union is very supportive. Marine shipping union workers are very supportive of this, as you might imagine. Longshoremen are supportive of this. It has support from the Association of Washington Businesses. That's a huge organization, and they've put their support behind this. So, yeah, there is support.
Jobs issues,
yes,
mostly.
Yes. And the jobs issues, the argument is that there will be several thousand jobs created around the creation of the terminal itself, the construction of the terminal up north. But for people in Seattle, and the reason we'll probably see a huge turnout today, is that the concern is that there are not as many jobs that are going to be distributed along those rail lines and through those communities that will bear the train traffic.
So what exactly is the scope of the hearing today? Is it all these issues, or are they focused on something more narrow?
So here's exactly what's going on here. And this is the challenge in covering this, is that people are so fired up about it,
right,
that we forget that it's very early in the process here. Right now, this is the scoping phase. So this is not the environmental impact statement. This is when they're taking public comment about what should be considered in the environmental impact statement that they will then produce in 2013. So people have until right now, these public hearings are happening. People can ask their questions, say, we want you to look at this, 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 and this. And by the way, there will be this many jobs created. They have until January 21st, okay, to make those comments. Then they go into the review process. Then they'll come out with the, it's going to go on for 2 years, probably, at the very least.
I know that you have covered the issue of who can speak and paying people to wait in line for you to speak. How many people are going to be speaking today, and who are they?
Well, it was discovered that the pro-coal export terminal, the proponents of coal exports, had been paying people to stand in line to hold spots. And after that was reported on KUOW, as well as on by a paper out east in Spokane, the Army Corps announced that they are going to have a lottery, basically. So you get your name picked, and then you get 2 minutes to talk. At the past hearings, it's been between 75 and 100. I'm not sure if they're going to take more, but the hearing goes from 4 to 7, and I'm pretty sure it'll be standard 75 to 100 speakers.
Are you expecting protests in the streets?
Oh, yeah. I'll be heading down there probably around lunchtime. Things are going to start heating up around 2 with rallies from both sides.
At the state, outside the convention.
Yeah, they're yeah. It's going to be interesting.
So, as you say, nothing is going to be decided today. Nothing's going to be decided till...
No. And the Army Corps has had thousands of comments already. And you can also, and that being said, if you can't make it today, you can email them, you can call them, you can deliver your comments in person. I mean, this is where it gets into a little bit of the public circus of all this. Yeah.
Ashley Ahern is our environmental reporter. She works with the Project EarthFix, and you'll hear her stories, I'm sure, later today. Thanks so much for being with us. And that hearing is from 4 to 7 at the Washington State Convention and Trade Center. And if you have to drive through that area unrelated to coal export terminals, maybe you want to take another route. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Marcy.
This is Weekday. Earlier this week, Michigan became the 24th state to enact a so-called right-to-work law. That law outlaws any requirements that workers join a union or pay union dues as a condition of employment. Not surprisingly, labor groups have decried the new law, but observers wonder if almost half the states have right-to-work laws. Is that the wave of the future for the country? Joining us to talk more about right-to-work laws and how they might impact Washington State is Jim Gregory. He's a professor of history at the University of Washington and past chair of the Harry Bridges Center for Labor Studies. Thanks for joining us.
I'm glad to join you.
I gave a really simplistic definition of right-to-work law. Do you want to expand on that a bit?
Well, these are laws that have been passed since 1947 when Congress authorized them. They basically say that states can prohibit companies and unions from agreeing to mandatory membership for unions, and also can limit mandatory dues or fee collection by unions.
And why are they called right-to-work laws?
That's one of the great euphemisms of all times, or misleading labels. It's a dubious right at best. It's like the right to not be represented by a union is like the right to not have vacations or not have health care. At least from the union perspective, they usually call it the right to work for less. You could also say these are not rights. They're basically wrongs.
The argument, I'm assuming, at least the argument in Michigan, is that somehow this is going to stimulate job creation or stimulate the economy. Is that correct?
That's the argument. A variety of arguments are used by the advocates for these kinds of limitations. They argue that it'll be the state will have less powerful unions, and so employers will be more likely to want to locate there. There's really mixed evidence on that. There have been a number of studies over the years, and most recently, following in 2001, Oklahoma became a state that passed a so-called right-to-work law. And in the aftermath, it doesn't appear that they benefited either by employers moving into the state or job creation at all. Certainly, you know, a lot of the so-called right-to-work states are in the South, and over the course of the last 40 years, many companies have moved out of the industrial belt, the Northeast, and relocated into the South. It's not just the legal framework; it's also lower wages, and different kinds of regulatory regimes in those states that have attracted those companies. So, the evidence of what this will do is at the very best mixed, and most likely effect for Michigan is no effect at all. It's not, most companies are not that interested in moving to Michigan. It's already a heavily industrialized state, and it's been losing population and losing jobs for a long time, and probably will continue to do so.
As you mentioned, Michigan is a heavily industrialized state. I am a Detroit native, and I come from the city that gave birth to one of the biggest unions in the country, the United Auto Workers Union. It seemed a particular irony that Michigan would pass such a law. And I wondered if you can compare Washington State with Michigan when it comes to union tradition.
Well, Michigan really is the citadel of American unionization. As you said, the birthplace of the United Auto Workers, the center place for the whole automobile industry, and really the symbol of strong unions. So this is a devastating symbolic blow to the labor movement, and a kind of real encouragement to conservatives who think that they can now continue to push these laws into other states. Washington also has a long tradition of strong labor unions, and it's one of the most heavily unionized per capita state in the country. I think it's highly unlikely, given the political complexion of the state, that we're going to see a successful right-to-work campaign in Washington. It certainly would require both houses of the legislature to be in the hands of Republicans and also a Republican governor, and we're a long way from that at the moment. But in general, this is an agenda that has been startlingly successful for conservatives, and they succeeded in passing similar legislation in Indiana and different kinds of anti-union legislation in Wisconsin, and briefly, although it was overturned, in Ohio. So we certainly are going to look for more of these attempts in other states that are under Republican control. It's not only a blow for the labor movement, it's really a serious problem for the Democratic Party. And I think most likely the greatest goal or the principal goal of these laws in the last couple of years is to weaken the Democratic Party. We've seen this unprecedented political warfare since 2008, and particularly new tactics, really the first time in a century that one party, in this case the Republican Party, has tried to undermine the other party by taking away funding, by by limiting voting access, you know, voter suppression, voter ID laws, rigorous attempts to reformulate districts to disenfranchise, to make them more Republican friendly. So all of these measures that we've seen in the last 4 years represent a different kind of political warfare than we're used to, and that's really, I think, the principal motive behind these right to work laws, and we'll probably see more of it.
Well, you mentioned that we don't have a Republican governor. We do have Republican control of the Senate as we go into the next legislative session. But Washington, unlike Ohio, is still not on a really strong road to economic recovery. And while we may not see introduction of a so-called right-to-work law in Washington state, might we see increased initiatives to cut back on at least state union workers' benefits and wages, as we've seen in the past 4 years?
Well, I think it's not likely with a Democratic control of the House and the governor's mansion in Washington state. It's not likely that you know, serious anti-unionism is going to get very far. There certainly are all sorts of proposals floating around, and public employees in Washington have given up a lot. I mean, they've lost lots of jobs and wage freezes and then furloughs, and so there have been, under Democratic leadership, real cutbacks and losses to state employees and public employees throughout the state, most of whom are unionized. So it hasn't been a good environment in Washington state for union workers or anybody else. But all of that has been sort of reasonably handled and argued through established channels, and the unions haven't been happy with it, but have sort of understood and agreed for the most part. But the serious kind of undermining of union strength and labor rights that we're seeing in the Midwest has not come to Washington state. And as I said, I think that's something that only a state that is completely controlled by the Republican Party is likely to see.
Now, just a last question to jump back to the Midwest. You mentioned Ohio. Some of the states where the economies are improving in heavily industrialized states, do you think that would maybe staunch cries for limits on union rights or wages and benefits?
I don't know. I think at a certain point this tactic is not going to work. The right to work legislation and the Wisconsin legislation have both been sort of sneak attacks. In this case, in the Michigan case, the governor Snyder always denied for 2 years. He denied that he had any interest to or would even sign a right to work bill, and then of course he turns around and did it. And the Republicans in the legislature pushed this through with no notice and kind of during a lame duck session when nobody was prepared. And similarly in Wisconsin, it had been sort of a sneak attack. So that strategy now is exposed, and the labor movement is on high alert in state after state, especially when there's a Republican governor. So I think it's going to be harder to accomplish these kinds of sneak attacks or real rollbacks in labor rights, just because the labor movement and their Democratic Party allies are now going to be very vigilant. And it's possible this is going to hurt Republicans in electoral contests, because now... and this tactic was used against Rob McKenna. The Democrats said, well, watch out, he says he's a moderate, but he, you know, will likely do this and this and this. And we have no idea whether he actually would have done that. But I think you're going to see those kinds of political claims by Democrats now that Republicans really will do sneak attacks and try to undermine unions and do other kinds of damage if you let them run a state. So there, you know, so it's all changing the political dynamics, and basically what we are seeing is both parties more mobilized, angrier, fighting over every little bit of turf possible, because the stakes now have become so serious for everyone involved.
Jim Gregory, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us.
You're very welcome.
Jim Gregory is a professor of history at the University of Washington and past chair of the Harry Bridges Center for Labor Studies. Earlier this week, Michigan became the 24th state to enact a so-called right-to-work law. This is Weekday on KUOW.
It's 9:26. You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW Seattle. I'm Andy Hurst. A proposal by Seattle Mayor Mike McGinn would allow buildings in the South Lake Union neighborhood to be built up to 400 feet high. Coming up next, we'll take a look at how you strike a balance for a city that's both dense and livable. Stay tuned.
Support for KUOW comes from Seattle Repertory Theater, presenting the holiday comedy Inspecting Carol, a behind-the-scenes spoof of a theater's annual production of A Christmas Carol, playing November 23rd through December 23rd. Tickets at seattlerep.org.
We have cloudy skies and 43 degrees in Seattle. Forecast says some morning fog, otherwise cloudy all day. The high in the mid-40s. It's going to be cloudy and rainy tonight. The low in the upper 30s.
Regional coverage of the environment through EarthFix, a Northwest public media partnership, is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the Real Networks Foundation.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. Steve shares off this week. The Seattle City Council's Committee on Planning, Land Use, and Sustainability is meeting this morning. They'll hear testimony on a proposal to dramatically increase height limits for new buildings in the South Lake Union neighborhood. This proposal comes on the heels of new zoning in other Seattle neighborhoods like Roosevelt area. Advocates say increasing density can help create demand for mass transit. It will help get people out of their cars, move them closer to their jobs, and in this case, in the South Lake Union area, it will put people right in a core of a new industry. But opponents say that 400-foot-tall buildings in South Lake Union will drastically alter the character of the area. They say the same thing for the Roosevelt neighborhood. They say the big buildings create canyons, they block views, and they're just unfriendly. There's no stopping growth in Seattle, and new development per se is not necessarily a bad thing. So we wanted to take a step back this morning and ask the questions, what kind of city do we want Seattle to be? How do we balance density with urban amenities? And joining us to talk about changes and how our city might compare to some of our neighbors in the Northwest are two people who spend a lot of time thinking about these questions. On the phone with us is Daniel Abramson. He's an associate professor of urban design and planning at the University of Washington. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Yes.
And in our studios is Mark Hinshaw. He's director of urban design with LMN Architects. He's an architect and urban planner, and he is a journalist who writes frequently about urban design and planning issues. Welcome to both of you. I guess I'll ask you specifically, since the city council's talking about this, Daniel Abramson, is increasing density in South Lake Union a good idea on the face of it in your mind?
Yes.
One word answer. Why?
Well, it's very close to downtown. It is an attractor for jobs and residents. It is an area which I think right now is seeing more construction than any other part of the whole state, and that is it's a natural place for this to happen. There is a lot of amenity and open space already provided by Lake Union itself. And it is a good thing to see people working and living and spending money in the city centers that we already have. because that is where we have the infrastructure to support that and can save on resources in the larger region.
And
if this is balanced with conservation in the outskirts.
Ah, well, that's something that we've been talking about for decades here. Mark Hinshaw, just ask you to weigh in on this.
Well, I would generally agree with that, but with some caveats. And I think that just having density by itself in a particular location isn't necessarily always a good thing, that it has to come with other things. And most people experience the city at the street level. What the quality of experience is along the sidewalks, the public rights of way, the streets, the parks, the courtyards, the what we call the public realm. And that's what really has to be nurtured and strengthened and cared for. And there can be a very boring public realm, uh-huh. or there could be a very lively and exciting one. And so we really have to make sure that that happens along with the density that might occur.
I'm going to read you, gentlemen, a quote about, I think it was 6 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago, I went up to Vancouver. I was doing a series of stories on Vancouver, British Columbia, and Seattle. And I met with Larry Beasley, who was the director of planning for the city of Vancouver at the time that the city upzoned. They made a conscious decision to funnel growth. And I was going to pull the tape, but I couldn't exactly find it. So this is a transcript of a conversation I had with him thinking about how to increase density. And they said, what we basically, this is Larry Beasley, we basically came up with a model that neighborhoods should be scaled so you can walk across them in 12 to 15 minutes. They should have a high street, sort of like the one we were standing on, with grocery stores, drug stores, and things clustered in cafes. They should have social infrastructure like schools if you want to attract families. And I believe that the Vancouver City Council, or whatever the body is that governs the city of Vancouver, requires of developers who want to put in some of those tall skyscrapers all of these things. They must build a school. They must build a food store. They must build in. And when I came back to Seattle, that wasn't something that we can require by code, at least the Department of Planning and Development at the time, the director at the time, Larry Rame, said that we could not require those sorts of things. And so I'm wondering, I know, Daniel Abramson, you travel up to Vancouver a lot with classes, correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so how do you compare how Vancouver officials and Seattle officials are looking at densification, increasing density, and what we need to go along with it?
Oh, that's a great question. I know Larry Beasley pretty well. I would also second everything that Mark said. And you do have to look at how density is experienced once you've made the decision to add density in a city center area. And there are fundamental differences. As Larry himself has said to my class, when I brought them up there, Canada is its crown land in the end. Constitutionally, the government has authority to negotiate with developers and to enforce very detailed design guidelines and land use requirements on developments that we do not have constitutionally here. So we have a different idea of what property rights are about, and the city and its relationship with developers is different as a result.
Well, I want Mark to follow up on that, because you mentioned boring or including amenities. So we've relied on incentives in this city. You can make extra stories of or you can build your building all the way out to the sidewalk if you do, you know, provide low-income housing, provide childcare, make it pretty, make a public space. There's a whole list of things that we've tried in Seattle, but I'm not sure that any of them has worked. So in your mind, if you take a step back philosophically, how can we, if we're trying to create something like Vancouver has, which is increased residential areas in a downtown core, increased density, how do we get those things?
Well, as much as I always appreciate going to Vancouver, because of the laws being different in the court cases and all of the other things that were mentioned that stand in the way of our being able to do some of those things, I think we can look to other communities like Portland and San Francisco, because they're using our same our same structure to get there. And they're using a combination of incentives and requirements. There's some things that are very difficult to require, such as a supermarket.
Right.
You can provide an incentive for that because the front-end cost is so great. But in fact, using your analogy of a high street, in that South Lake Union area, Westlake essentially is the high street.
Right.
It could be a lot better. It could have a lot more choices and a lot more variety along it. But after all, it is anchored already by a supermarket. It's likely to be anchored by other destinations in the future. But we're getting there. I don't think we have all of the tools that we need and all of the things that we want to see there, but we're moving probably generally in the right direction. I don't think it's certainly not a disaster area by.
Well, at this point, right now, what the city councils, they change their name every week, so I have to look at what the title is of their committee. It's Planning, Land Use, and Sustainability, as opposed to the built environment, which it was 6 months ago. But Daniel Abramson, you talked about how you thought it was a good thing to be funneling density into a downtown core close to jobs. How do we, as a city or as a society, think about not just funneling density, but creating neighborhoods, vital urban neighborhoods, if we can't use the stick that our Canadian neighbors can?
Well, there are sticks we can use, and there are some we're a little afraid to use that we haven't tried and maybe need to be willing to defend them in courts.
Like what?
Well, I think tax increment financing is something we can attach to, to infrastructure development where we bet on the increased tax revenues that a development can achieve over time. In order to finance something now that is more locally related to a particular district or development. That's something we're afraid to do because of a state constitution. We could try that. And then there are also transfer of development rights rules. We tend to undercut those right now. That allows you to preserve a building, for example, or include some incentive zoning or achieve any kind of public good in exchange for increased density somewhere else where you really want it. The problem is we keep upzoning and allowing increased density anyway, and then we don't have that incentive to offer to people. So there are lots of things that we can still work with. But I would remind everyone, that when we talk about a vital urban center, we're not just talking about density. I completely agree. We're talking about the mixing of residents and business and consumption in a small walkable area. You mentioned that, but we're also talking about mixing up different income groups, people of different means, businesses of different sizes, and we're also talking about mixing age of a building so that not everything is new all at once. One of the problems with Vancouver that they've discovered is they built so much in one short amount of time that it's all going to get old at the same time, too, about 40, 50 years or 70 years from now. And no one's quite sure how to deal with that once you've got an enormous amount of construction that's all going to age it together.
Well, I want to throw that to Mark Hinshaw, because something that I saw recently was about the few remaining row houses that are in the South Lake Union neighborhood. One of them has been turned into a fabulous restaurant that I went to. But in fact, South Lake Union is similar to Vancouver in that way, in that there are some historic buildings that have been landmarked for preservation. So at least their exteriors have been preserved, or they've been built into a bigger complex. But if you go down and walk around, a lot of it is of similar age and kind of similar style. So from the non-boring point of view, because you use that word, I mean, in the best possible way, what would you like to see South Lake Union look like?
Well, again, I think we can draw from some examples that we can see right now in Portland. And there's two districts there. One is the South Waterfront District, which has got some similarity to South Lake Union, and the Pearl District, which is the other end of downtown, which also has some similarity. They're all relatively new. In fact, South Waterfront is all new.
Right.
There were no existing buildings there before. But what Portland has done is make sure that they're, through a variety of techniques, that there's a whole host of very small storefronts and businesses that cater to local people. There are very few chains in there, very few national brands. They're places that nurture homegrown small businesses to occupy small spaces.
So do they variety. So do they actually have regulations that national chains cannot come into those areas?
I'm not aware that they actually prevent that, but they try to get the storefronts to be very narrow, like you see in often very good shopping streets and even, for that matter, shopping centers,
mm-hmm.
So that you, in a given block length of several hundred feet, you don't just have a bank and a cafe, you have six different things going on there. And that usually requires a combination of incentives and sticks that say, for example, you can't have a storefront wider than 100 feet. You can't occupy the whole frontage with the lobby to a building. You have to have variety. And those are not testing the limits of law. I mean, those are certainly tested already elsewhere and found to be defensible. So we just need to employ some of those tools that already exist and are in use elsewhere.
Well, I think one of the techniques is something I'm not even sure if it's a requirement in Seattle, but a design review board or commission, and we have them. I know we've had them for quite some time. Most recently, talking about townhouse development, we had a sort of virus infection of townhouse developments where there was a driveway in the middle. Everybody had a garage, and these four to six home townhomes were sort of like little block houses. And I know there was a lot of reaction against that. Aren't aesthetics in the eye of the beholder?
Well, I'm not sure that we're actually talking about pure aesthetics here. I think we're talking about urban design principles that just have worked for many hundreds of years in cities. And that's, we can study those things that work. It's not necessarily just personal aesthetic opinion. It's the relationship of doors and windows and overhead weather protection and sidewalk elements and places to sit and lighting to make sure that it's a friendly place at night. It's eyes on the street. I mean, there's some very classic, well-tested principles of building cities that have proven, you know, proven to work. And we don't have to reinvent the wheel.
Daniel Abramson, if you had, I mean, maybe the city of Seattle brings you in to advise them, but if you had one priority piece of advice that you could give them in terms of densification in South Lake Union or the Roosevelt neighborhood or Ballard or any other place, Columbia City, what would that be?
Well, I would repeat some of the things Mark said. I also think that we need to work very hard to preserve those elements of the streetscape or those actual buildings that have been there for some time. We need to work harder to work existing structures into new construction so that there is this sense of connection with the past. It's that which really creates a sense of identity in a place. No matter how good the design is, if everything is completely new, it's going to be very difficult to ensure that it has a unique quality to it. You know, I'm not as familiar with Portland as Mark is. I do know that the Pearl District has evolved in a quite different way from the way South Lake Union is, and I think very successfully there. They have larger buildings that are older, so it makes them perhaps more economically feasible in some cases to upgrade and renovate. But we need to work hard on that edge, I would say harder than has been the case.
Daniel Abramson is an associate professor of urban design and planning at the University of Washington. Mark Hinshaw is an architect, urban planner, and journalist. He writes very frequently about urban design and development. He's director of urban design with LMN Architects. Gentlemen, thanks both for joining us. And the City of Seattle's Committee on Planning, Land Use, and Sustainability is meeting as we speak to talk about upzoning the South Lake Union neighborhood. This is Weekday.
There's an app that can send a car service to wherever you are in minutes. Makes everybody happy, right? Yeah, no.
When you can get a classy ride in 5 minutes, that can make a lot of folks in the taxi industry pretty nervous.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the CEO of Uber, the car service, and the numbers from Wall Street as well. Next time on Marketplace, it's from APN.
That story and more coming up tonight at 6:30. Good morning, it's 9:44. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information.
Support for KUOW comes from Hear Music, presenting Holidays Rule, a newly recorded collection of seasonal music featuring Fun, Punch Brothers, Paul McCartney, and others. Holidays Rule, now available at Starbucks.
We have cloudy skies and 43 degrees in the U District. Forecast says morning fog, otherwise mostly cloudy all day, temperatures in the mid-40s. Cloudy and rainy tonight, the low in the upper 30s. We're expecting some rain in the morning tomorrow, tapering off to just a chance of rain throughout the day. Tomorrow's high in the low 40s.
Support for KUOW comes from Top 10 Toys, whose mission is keeping healthy play alive with classic hands-on toys. Open every day in the Greenwood neighborhood of North Seattle and in Pacific Place in downtown Seattle.
In 1917, the elite of Tsarist Russia were crushed practically overnight by the Communist Revolution. So what happened to the nearly 2 million people who lived at the top of Russian society after they were dispossessed? Douglas Smith explores this question in his new book, Former People, The Final Days of the Russian Aristocracy. He joins us this morning at 10:05.
From KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. Every Thursday on weekday, we pause to contemplate a facet of the huge jewel that's Seattle's arts and cultural community. We call the segment The Art of Our City. Usually I talk about it with Steve Scher, so now I'm just going to talk about it with myself. Today, something new, a project called Custom Made Play Project. And joining me in the studio to talk about the project itself and the two-woman play that launches the project are Rebecca Olson, who is the project creator.
Is yes. That?
Yeah. And she's performing in the debut play Ballard House Duet, which was written by playwright Paul Mullen. And the show debuted last weekend and it runs through this weekend at Washington Ensemble Theater on Capitol Hill. Thanks, both of you, for coming in.
And thank you for having us.
I guess, Rebecca, tell me what the Custom Made Play Project is.
Well, the Custom Made Play Project is a new project. It's based on the old version of making plays, and I shouldn't say old, the historic way of making plays, which is that a playwright was writing for a particular company of actors and for a very specific audience, like Shakespeare.
I was just going to say, like Shakespeare.
Just like Shakespeare. So when Shakespeare was commissioned to write a comedy for the Queen's Birthday, for example, he could look at his company of actors and say, we're going to be doing this in January after Christmas. Let's write a play called Twelfth Night, and I've got these two brothers who look alike, so let's write it, but they can both play ingenues, so we'll make one a boy and one a girl and make them twins, you know. And so the idea of the play, I'm totally making this up, I don't know if that's actually true. But you know, the play itself was based on the audience that he was writing for, but also the people that were performing the roles. And we have moved really, really far away from that. Paul can speak to that more specifically as a playwright, but we've moved really far away from that, the way that playmaking works now in the especially modern American theater, where playwrights are kind of expected to just generate genius alone, like a novelist, and then try to sell that idea to a theater, try to find actors to fit the roles of these characters that they've imagined in their mind. And I think that it's a much more difficult process. But.
Well, so Shakespeare over there, Paul Mullen, so Rebecca came to you with this idea?
She did. She said, did you want to write a play specifically for myself and Hannah Lass? And I was like, yeah, I could do that.
Have you ever done anything like that?
I've written with people in mind for characters that I already had in mind of my own invention. This was different. I created the characters from whole cloth with the intention of fitting them exactly to Hannah and Rebecca. And I interviewed Hannah and Rebecca and got some of their life story. And it was a chance for me to be nosy. one of the things we found out that all three of our families have hoarders in our family. So I said, oh, okay, well, maybe hoarding can be a component of the story. And it is. It's kind of the background of the story.
Well, the play's called Ballard House Duet. The duet is Rebecca and Hannah Lass, who are the two actors. And they're supposed to be sisters.
They are. Adopted sisters, though. That was the other fun thing. It's like, what's the relationship between these two actors? Obviously, it's radio. You can't see Rebecca, but she's a beautiful, blonde-haired, Nordic-looking woman. And then Hannah is a beautiful but clearly, like, mixed-race, dark woman. And I was like, well, let's just go with the actual history, which is Hannah is half Asian, so let's make her adopted, and then we can work. So, you know, you start to get the circumstances of the play from trying to fit it to the actors. It's almost easier in a way because you don't have to make as much up. You just kind of fit it.
So you were nosy. You interviewed them. You talked to them. Yeah. And then, Rebecca, were there any other besides want to write a play with us in mind? Any kind of requirements, limitations?
Absolutely. I said, I'm producing this, which means I have no money. So you need to write us a play that I can produce on a really small budget. I said that right at the top, you know, no working sinks, no swimming pools on stage, nothing like that. And he did. So that he took that as another challenge parameter, which I think, again, like you said, it made it easier because
that's what it is. I mean, everybody, you know, when I teach playwriting, I always say problems are your friends in playwriting because that's what we write is problems. We don't write solutions. We, you know, Macbeth is a big problem. So, you know, when you get these parameters, they tend to box you in, which is right where you want to be. It's boxed in. So, yeah.
And then we also talked about using this as an opportunity for Hannah and I as actors to get to play roles that we don't normally get to play. So part of the interview process was Paul being nosy about our personal lives, but part of it was also asking questions like, what do you think your strengths are as an actor? What do you think your weaknesses are? What kind of role have you always wanted to play that you've never gotten to do before?
So really, really tailor-made to you.
Really tailor-made. The entire story, there was no story before he interviewed us. He did not come to us with an idea for a play. He came to us with interviews, and the entire fabric of the play is based entirely on those interviews and then follow-up emails that happened afterwards.
And how much of a departure is that from the way you normally work, Paul?
You know, like perpendicular, like straight off the page, like not the same. But it's really, really fun, and I will probably try and, you know, orient myself so that I can do it again, because Seattle has such amazing acting talent. And frankly, one of the tragedies of Seattle theater is that we have amazing acting talent and amazing playwriting talent, and we don't get to work together very much.
Why is that?
Well, part of it's equity rules. We have a different set of equity rules here in Seattle than New York. And LA.
Equity is the union that governs stage actors.
Yes.
Correct.
And managers, but not certainly not player. I don't know. No. Do you even have a
There's
union?
There's something called the Dramatists Guild, which is very loose and not as constrictive in the kind of work we can do.
But essentially, the rules don't allow you to work together?
Well, not in the same way as in New York, where there's a 99-seat waiver, which means if it's there are other aspects of it, but actors can work for free on new work if the theater is small enough. L.A. has a similar showcase rule, and I think Chicago might as well.
And Seattle doesn't because it's too small a city, or what?
We haven't gotten the right people in there to advocate for
Yeah, I think it's a matter of advocating for it.
Because Washington Ensemble Theater, I once counted, I don't think there's 99 seats in there.
It is. It's a 49 seat. It's a very, very intimate little space. But we are paying. I mean, Hannah is a partial producer on this project, and she is. We do have to have an equity contract for her to be working at that theater.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
So she cannot, because she's an equity actor, she cannot work in a house that doesn't have.
She has to be paid an equity contract.
Yikes.
Yeah.
So this is the debut play.
Yes.
You had last weekend, you have this weekend, and in that 49-scene house, you can probably still find a seat sometime this weekend. What happens next with the custom-made play project? Have you thought that far?
Yes, I've started to. So I have two actors in mind who have already committed with me to do it. One is Betsy Schwartz and the other is Kelly Kitchens. And we are in the process of discussing which playwright we want to approach. So this is also an entirely different way of working. One of the other aspects of this project, in addition to supporting new work and getting actors and playwrights together, is that I wanted to give actors more of a creative input into the process.
You know, it seems like I'm hearing a lot of actors, maybe not commissioning playwrights to write plays for them, but there are actors that seem to be banding together to do work that they want to do. There's the Seagull Project that Julie Briskman's heading up. There's Strindberg Plays. There's, you know, a lot of folks, the Sandbox Radio at West of London. Which is, you know, a huge group of writers and performers who are kind of generating your own work. Is that because there's nothing else to do or because there's a scarcity?
There's a scarcity of work. There always is a scarcity of work as an actor, regardless of what city you're in or what level you're at. So that's always true. But it does seem like recently, especially maybe the recession, I'm not sure what it is, that it seems like there's even less. But part of it for me is also the actor has become very, very far down on the ladder in terms of the creative process. I mean, we're by the time I'm brought into rehearsal, all of the creative decisions have been made for the most part. You know, the play's been written, the director's been chosen, the designers have already designed, they've designed the world. I'm told what costume I'm going to be wearing and where we're setting it. You know, all of those things have already been decided. And so my job, my creative input as an actor is simply to try and take everybody else's decisions and make it look like they came from me, which is a skill, but it has become unsatisfying. And I think that's true for a lot of actors. I think that we want to have more of an input into the world that we are creating on stage. What story are we telling? Why are we telling it?
Well, you get a chance to see the debut production of Rebecca Olson's custom-made play project. It's called Ballard House Duet, written by Paul Mullen, and it's at the Washington Ensemble Theater on 19th Avenue on Capitol Hill, Thursday through
Monday. Monday night, the 17th, is our closing.
And you can find a link for ticket information at our website, kuow.org. Rebecca Olson and Paul Mullen, thanks for being with us.
Thank you
so much, Marcy.
This is Weekday on KUOW. And now, the sound of the day. That's the sound of Tibetans from the Seattle area joining with Tibetans from Vancouver, British Columbia at a rally for human rights in Tibet. That rally was held Monday at the entrance to the Chinese embassy in Vancouver. Let's hear a little bit more of them. Well, our listener, Kurt, sent us that sound. He attended the rally, and I don't know if he provided a translation. I'm kind of wondering what these Tibetans were actually saying specifically. It's kind of fascinating. If you've got an interesting sound that you've heard, you can record 30 seconds and send it to us, along with the story behind what you heard. Email that sound to weekday@kuow.org. includes sound of the day in the subject line, and you'll hear it on the air. Well, I have to say that our good friends, producers Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, and Amina Al-Sadi, they have a goal, and their goal is the number 4,000. That is 4,000 Facebook friends for Weekday at KUOW. We only need 140 more of you listeners to go to Facebook, search out Weekday, and friend us. It shouldn't be too hard to get 140 more. I think they're likes. They're not friends anymore if you have an organizational page. But the goal is 4,000. It's gleaming out there in the future. So if this is a program that you like, that you listen to, why not join us on Facebook Weekday at Weekday on KUOW at Facebook. You can listen to archived programs at our website. That's kuow.org. Search out Weekday and you'll find them. Coming up on the program, the frenzy of live radio, as you can hear in my voice right now, always frenzied. Katie Sewell is here with the radio retrospective. Sarah Dickerman comes in, and we're going to talk about the best cookbooks to give to the chefs and eaters in your life. And we're going to talk about the fall of the Russian aristocracy with writer and historian Douglas Smith, the author of a book called Former People. That is coming up in the next hour. You will not want to miss it.
Good morning. It's a minute before 10. Headlines from NPR News, less than 2 minutes away. Stay tuned.
Lego blocks, toys that are simple but pricey and nearly immune to competition.
If you were talking to a friend, you wouldn't say, "Oh my God, I just got a big set of Mega blocks."
The economic mystery of Legos.
When you say Legos, they would probably be like, "Awesome, can I go to your house and play?"
Today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That story and much more today from 3 until 6:30. This is 94.9 KUOW FM Seattle, 1340 Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and Digital H.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.